Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 172, recorded Tuesday, February 16th, 2021. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: timeshares without the pitch and notes on Tucson. Coming to you again from the Travel Commons studios in Chicago, Illinois, on, depending on where you are, it's Fat Tuesday or Shrove Tuesday or Pancake Tuesday. But here in Chicago, with a big Polish population, it's Punchki Day. And I had mine for breakfast. Polish filled donuts, went for raspberry jam and a custard one. Kind of needed that fueling because what has been one of the mildest winters on record here in Chicago started reverting to the mean at the beginning of the month this February. The last day the temperature cracked freezing was about 2 weeks ago, and it has snowed 13 out of the past 17 days. I mean, we were all waiting for this, veterans of Midwest winters. It got me thinking, though, that, I don't know, maybe Irene and I should have delayed our trip to Tucson from the third week of January, when the temperatures were kind of topping out in the mid-40s, to last week, or maybe this week, when we could have enjoyed a, say, 50 to 60 degree temperature differential. You know, but even without kind of the guilty pleasure of posting schadenfreude trolling Instagram pictures of sunshine and temperature readings, we had a good week in Tucson. The flights out and back on Southwest were uneventful and not full. The Airbnb was fine. The desert hikes were great. And we hit some good restaurants and tap rooms, which, as I talked about in the last episode, was the main reason we pivoted from our original destination, lockdown, shutdown, San Diego, to Tucson. Probably our only disappointment was not finding a great margarita, which, though, we managed to fix in the Amex Centurion Lounge in Phoenix while waiting for our flight home. I'll talk more about Tucson later in the episode, but I did write up a whole blog post with all the details. If you go to the episode description in your podcast app, there's a link that should be clickable that'll take you straight to that post. Now, even though Southwest's open middle seat pledge expired in December, Delta's the last one standing there, no one landed in the middle seat between Irene and I on our midway to Phoenix flight. Now, that flight was a lot longer than I remember it being last year when I was doing it weekly. I think probably that has something to do with the mask. Before getting on the plane, I switched from my standard Evolve Together surgical style mask to a Korean version of the N95, decided to dial it up, not knowing if I was going to be shoulder to shoulder with a stranger for over 3 hours. Actually, the KN95 mask wasn't too uncomfortable as masks go, so I didn't swap it out for my other mask when the middle seat stayed empty. My strategy with Southwest's open seating was to go about 3/4 of the way to the back of the plane, you know, about halfway past the exit row. I figured this would mean fewer people walking past us, but would still be far enough away from the rear lavatories to avoid, you know, kind of the in-flight queues. And since people still want to get off the plane quickly, if the last boarding groups, the C groups, were left with just middle seats, I figured they'd probably take them in the front of the cabin. Now, as it turned out, I don't know, maybe I overthought this a bit. I didn't see any occupied middle seats in either the front or the back of the plane on our flight out. But then, a couple of days before our flight home, I got the dreaded email from Southwest. The flight, they said, may not allow for an open middle seat next to you. I waited until the night before to tell Irene this. She's a little bit more COVID risk adverse than me, and I didn't want her stewing on it for a couple of days. But it ended up turning out okay. She grabbed the second exit row, which was a two-seater, an aisle and a middle seat, no window seat. And actually, looking behind us, I didn't see any row with an occupied middle seat. So either people swapped their flights after receiving that email, or the flight was just a shade over 2/3 full with any of those occupied middle seats maybe in the front of the plane, as I thought. And I have to say, those margaritas from the Centurion Lounge helped the flight home go a little bit faster than the flight out. So following up, So the story of the guy who lived for 3 months on the secure side of O'Hare's domestic terminals after getting off his flight from L.A., and he was able to hang around because he was using an airport ID badge that an airport operations manager had reported missing back in October. Kind of, I don't know, shades of Tom Hanks' character in The Terminal. But I got to tell you, I mean, O'Hare's a big airport, but it's not sort of hang out for 3 months unnoticed big. There are hundreds of TSA, Chicago police, airport security staff running around the place, not to mention all the airline gate agents, wheelchair porters, restaurant workers, and airport maintenance staff. And not one of them noticed this guy wandering around at all hours with an expired badge. And even with passenger volumes cut in half, I mean, until finally two United Airlines workers asked to see his ID. I mean, this is bad. This is like Cats the Movie level bad, like Fire Festival level bad. I mean, it seems that 20 years on from 9/11, that whole sort of see something, say something has faded. The TSA and the Chicago Department of Aviation should have to come up with some answers on this one. But I don't know, a month on, I haven't heard anything. I haven't seen anything. I think they'll end up quietly dropping the charges and just bury the thing, hoping that the next guy is a bit more obvious. In the last episode, I wondered what the airlines and hotels will do about elite status protection if travel continues to be slow throughout the summer, and I closed that comment by saying it'll be interesting to see what they offer come May. Well, I have to tell you, I was off by, I don't know, 4 or 5 months. Things are moving fast. A week after posting that episode, I got an email from Southwest saying that they were extending my companion pass status from June to the end of the year, to December, so tacking on another 6 months. And then I got offers from both American and United for status qualifier accelerators. So, this slow rollout of the coronavirus vaccines is cutting into what has been, or what was really, an end of the year travel planning spurt. Value Penguin, we've talked to them in prior episodes about travel credit cards. They did a survey in December and found people getting revved up for travel. 16% of respondents booked travel as a result of the vaccine approvals. 34% had bought plane tickets within the last month. And in a turnaround from earlier in the year, 47% had increased use of travel credit cards to earn miles to fund their next trip. But 2 months on from this survey, you already hear some folks starting to write off the summer, which, with airlines talking about new furloughs and hotel unemployment back up to 23% in January, that is not great news for anybody. Also in the email bag, I got notes both from Iberia and British Airways reminding me that I have Avios balances. That's their frequent flyer points. I've got Avios balances with each of them that are expiring. Iberia's at the end of March, BA's at the end of the year. Kind of interesting difference in those warning periods. Now, Iberia and BA merged 10 to 11 years ago to form IHG, kind of the overall holding company, which then later bought Aer Lingus. And now all three of them use Avios points for their frequent flyer programs, but they keep those programs separate. So now I've got different Avios balances at all three airlines. Now, for most of these programs, you need to have some activity, say, over 24 to 36 months to keep your point balance, though. You know, some airlines have extended these timelines for COVID, but apparently not Iberia or BA. Now, in the past, the easiest thing to do was transfer some minimum number of credit card points, say from Chase or Amex. It was usually just 1,000 points, and that activity would reset the clock. I was about to run that play again, but something made me check out the rules first. And sure as hell, the Iberia website says that transferring miles doesn't count as activity. Now, while Iberia's and BA's Avios programs are separate, you actually can transfer points between them if you dig hard enough. Back in episode 136, I talked about burning a Saturday afternoon trying to figure this out, but they've made it easier in the intervening years. I scrounged around and found the page I needed to transfer all of my Iberia Avios points to my BA account. I'll give it, I don't know, a month to see if BA considers this transfer as enough activity to reset that 36-month clock. If not, I'll have, you know, I don't know, till the end of the year to figure it out, to try an Amex transfer or maybe code a night's stay at a Marriott or a Hyatt to my BA account. And again, that'll qualify as activity. This whole exercise, though, reminded me to make the rounds of my other sort of odds and ends loyalty programs to see what else might be expiring. I mentioned in the last segment that Irene and I hit the Phoenix Amex Centurion Lounge before flying home from our desert hiking week. I've talked in past episodes how these lounges are just heads and shoulders above the regular U.S. airline lounges. Great food, open bars, the only problem, not enough of them, and because they're a great deal, they get crowded. Or they did pre-COVID. Walking into the Phoenix Centurion Lounge, we saw maybe a dozen people. Now, they're still serving food, but now they've got staff dishing it out for you from the buffet line. But we'd picked up a couple of sandwiches from Pizzeria Bianco, which is a great pizza and panini place in Phoenix. Love it. So we weren't looking for food. We were just looking for drinks. I thought about a beer, but walking up to the bar, the tequila bottle caught my eye, reminding me that we had not been able to find a good margarita in Tucson. The bartender solved that problem. She made two great margaritas. So good that I wanted to squeeze one more in before heading down to the gate. Walked up to the bar, different bartender. I hoped her margaritas were as good. She looked at me for a moment and then said, "I have to be honest with you, I've never made a margarita before, but I'll give it a try." Turns out she was one of the girls from the buffet line standing in for the bartender while the bartender was on break. And I could have pivoted to a beer, but when she said, "I'll give it a try," I said, "No problem. I'll walk you through it. Look, grab the shaker, fill it with ice. Take the tequila bottle. Now, don't pour it straight in there. Just, you know, fill the large end of that jigger. Pour that into the shaker. Now turn the jigger over and fill the short end from that bottle of Cointreau. Now pour that in. Now a short shot of the lime juice in that little squeeze bottle. Now put the lid on it, shake it. Now strain it into that martini glass. We'll skip the salt rim." She was great. A little nervous, but she did. She was game for it. She did a great job. We thanked each other. Me thanking her for yet another good margarita. She thanking me for what? I don't know. Not being a miserable entitled platinum card holder. Absolutely, though, my best Centurion Lounge experience yet. And hey, if you've got any travel experiences, stories, questions, comments, tips, rants, the voice of the traveler, send them along. Comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. You can send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page or the Instagram account at Travel Commons. Or as always, you can post them on the website at travelcommons.com. The first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is timeshares without the pitch. Now, for our Tucson trip, Irene ended up booking on Airbnb what turned out to be somebody's timeshare rental in a golf resort west of Tucson. Now, that was a new one for us and a little different than the typical Airbnb experience. We had to put down a credit card for incidentals, and then we had to check out and check back in sort of halfway through the stay. But it was a nice place, and better yet, we didn't get trapped in a small room for an hour-long sales pitch. And so when I got back home and got a note from Mike Kennedy introducing me to Koala, which is a timeshare rental search platform that he co-founded and then launched last August, I asked him to come onto the podcast to talk about timeshare rentals and how they fit into the travel ecosystem. Mike, first question, help us understand how timeshare rental fits into that spectrum of accommodations that travelers might be more familiar with. If I think about that spectrum, I could go from hotels to B&Bs to vacation rentals to private home rentals.
That's a great question. And there's kind of a natural bifurcation in options when you're kind of selecting accommodations for vacations. You're either going down the route of an Airbnb or a Vrbo, and you're saying, I want to rent a home because we want some space. Or you're typically saying, we want to stay in something that is a hotel. But in those two scenarios, you typically have compromises. And the compromises with hotels is that, especially if you have a family, you're typically getting one hotel room and cramming your family in or getting adjoining hotel rooms. But you get the confidence that it's managed by Marriott or Hilton, et cetera. Conversely, if you're getting a home rental, it's the opposite. So you have the ability to kind of rent a whole home. You don't have to leave three times a day for meals. However, you don't know who it's being cleaned by, or, you know, what protocols are being upheld. And in today's world, those things are really, really, really uber important. The timeshare product is the only natural hybrid product on the marketplace. You have all of the benefits and features of your vacation rentals, like the living rooms, the shared bedrooms, your washer and dryers, all that space that you want from a vacation rental, but it's managed by like a Marriott or a Hilton. And it has resort amenities like swimming pools, check-in desks, things like that, that give you the confidence again in today's world that people really want. You know, and before us, the options to get one of these was to pay a lot of money on these OTAs, these online travel agencies, through a rental, or to go and buy into one of these programs. And that's not really either affordable or even appealing to a lot of people.
What does Koala offer travelers that, say, Airbnb doesn't? I recently rented a Club Wyndham timeshare in Tucson from an owner on Airbnb. So how would that transaction be different, better, more optimized on Koala?
So a couple things. One, you don't see a lot of timeshare inventory on Airbnb for the reasons I'm about to discuss. And that is because it is not a platform that is built for that product.
What are some of the unique pieses that make Airbnb not optimized for the
timeshare
inventory?
If you own a home, you can open up a calendar for 365 and you can set different prices and different availabilities based off of that open calendar. If you own a timeshare, you typically own a 7-day interval.
Right.
And how do you fit that into some place where it gets visibility for someone that may not be searching for those exact beginning and end dates? Right. So what ends up happening is that a lot of people show up to the resorts and their reservations are incorrect or wrong or just not there at all. You know, it is a system because there's a little bit of a square peg in a round hole. I mean, don't get me wrong. It sounds like you had a fine experience, but they don't manage that in a way that it's designed to be managed. There's a third party involved in this, the resort. When it's an Airbnb, it's a host and it's a traveler. And those two will figure out and they arrange something and they check into that host stay. With a resort stay, there is a third party. There's a guest certificate transfer that happens on the back end to ensure that your name as a traveler gets switched to the reservation ledger in the system to ensure that the guest gets that kind of walks into that check-in successfully. We do all that. There are extra steps involved that we ensure, and we handle all of that.
So it feels like you're acting as an OTA, an online travel agency, like an Orbitz, like an Expedia, to provide search, discovery, and then booking.
Yeah.
As you were working toward your August launch, what were some of the biggest challenges you faced in getting that inventory so that people could search and book?
That is the question, right? So I know this from my time in Hilton Club that there was a problem in how people underutilized their timeshares but still had fees to pay. And, you know, that went from I bought this thing, I don't understand it, all the way up to I loved it for 10 years, I'm just done with it. And now what? Right. And everything in between. But at the end of the day, if you have a $2,000 annual fee to pay, it becomes a problem. So I knew that it was something that if we connected with these owners, we could help solve that problem for them. What we didn't understand was that in many cases, these owners don't even know what they own. They don't know where to start. It's not like you have a vacation rental and you're like, oh, here's the house. I'm going to take some photos. I'm going to throw up a price and I'm going to rent a couple nights out and I'll adjust the cost per night based off of rentals. It's like, you just have this thing that is either a fixed week or it's not. It's a specific resort or it's not. And in many cases, people don't really know what they've bought. And in some cases, they bought something and then upgraded to something else. So that was by far the biggest problem, was getting people to understand what they own. How do you create an asset out of that and you know, leverage that asset in a way that could earn you some revenue? It's still a process that we're going through, like really making it very, very simple. You know, we're not really just tapping into this supply. We're really empowering a whole group of people to understand this process.
Hey, Mike, last question. How did you get this idea? How did you how'd you get started down this path?
Good question. I was a musician when I was in my 20s, and I kind of meandered into residential real estate and real estate market in 2007 in New York. Everywhere was just kind of flat. So one of my good friends was like, you should come check out this condo hotel. It's fractional real estate. I go, what the heck is fractional real estate? I have no idea. She's like, come check it out. It's Hilton. I'm like, all right. I went in there. I'm like, this is cool. Like everyone's, there's a lot of hustle and bustle. Like my office is kind of dead. This is our office is like moving. So I joined the team. 3 weeks into training, I was like, is this a timeshare? They're like, yeah. No idea. I was already hired in the job. It's really started to resonate with me the more and more time I spent with people that I sold. Like after they're coming in over and over again, and we're like trying to upgrade them into something else. It was cool when you like, all right, this product is great, but like, now people are looking for ways out and I don't have answers for them. The solutions weren't there on the back end that I was hoping for. So it really was a direct result of me being in touch with those situations that I felt like I can help. And yeah, I took the leap and I said, look, this is a problem we're solving. I think the industry is great. I think there's a lot of upside. I think it's got a bad rap, but I think if we kind of, you know, mitigate some of that and amplify what people love about this industry, I think it'll go a long way.
Fantastic. Mike Kennedy, CEO and co-founder of Koala. Mike, thanks for joining us on the Travel Commons podcast.
Thanks, Mark.
The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast, Notes on Tucson. Now, as I said at the top of the show, Irene and I had a good trip to Tucson at the end of January, pretty much just hiking and eating and drinking. I wrote it up in a blog post on the Travel Commons website, Quick Notes on Our Trip to Tucson. Though I got to tell you, at over 1,700 words, it did kind of get away from me. I'm not sure it still qualifies as quick. But there are some pictures and there's links to all the parks and restaurants and tap rooms we enjoyed. And there's also a link to the Tucson Instagram story that I built for the Travel Commons Instagram page if you want to see some more informal pictures. We flew into Phoenix rather than Tucson because the nonstop flights were cheaper and there were more of them. I was going to rent a car anyways. You know, we were going to be driving around to different parks for hiking and whatnot. But I just didn't know Tucson, never been there before. So I wanted that flexibility. But anyhow, since we were going to rent a car, the 100-mile drive straight down I-10 seemed to be a good trade-off for better flights and better prices. The only hitch in that plan was the bus between the terminal and the rental car center. They limit capacity on the bus to 15 people, which made sense. However, they didn't add any buses to make up for that lost capacity. It wasn't a problem we got on the bus at the terminal, but the queue at the rental car center just stretched the length of the entire center all the way across the front. You know, hundreds of people trying to get back to make their flights. I saw some people bailing out and calling Ubers. Now, I made a note of this to add kind of an extra 30 minutes to our return time for our flight back. Turned out we didn't need it. We walked straight from the Hertz lot onto the bus, but that was okay. I used that time to give my margarita lesson. Definitely a greater good. Tucson sits kind of at the bottom of, I don't know, about five sets of smallish mountains. I don't know, they're kind of an awkward size, bigger than hills, but except for the Santa Catalinas, they don't feel big enough to be truly called mountains, which was okay because all we wanted to do was hike, well, really walk the trails, and to be outside under blue skies in the high 60s, low 70s. I mean, that's what we really wanted to do, to take a break from kind of gray Chicago and to be far enough away from people that we could walk around without wearing masks. Now, back in episode 168, we talked about traveling for food, that food is one experience of a place that can't be exported and bought online. In that episode, I talked about eating our way through South Philly and then before that, doing a pasty tour of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. In Tucson, the hunt was for Sonoran food, a type of Mexican cuisine that you don't see much outside of, well, the Sonoran Desert, southern Arizona and the Mexican state of Sonora. It hasn't broken out kind of the way that, say, Tex-Mex or Baja or Oaxacan styles of Mexican food have. It's all about the beef, mostly carne asada, grilled over mesquite wood, and then served in a thin flour tortilla that's more like the wrappers you get with Chinese mandarin food, kind of like with Peking duck or mushu pork. It's more like that than the thick flour tortillas that, say, you get with fajitas. Cross-referencing a couple of local food blogs, I had a list of places to try. And honestly, that list was pretty much hit and miss. Mostly misses the first couple of nights, which got a little bit depressing. But then we hit gold at the end of our stay. And looking back at that list, I think we tried the nicer places on the list first. They weren't bad. I mean, they were fine, but they just weren't places that I'd go out of my way to recommend. After that sort of, I don't know, not disappointment, that's too strong of a word, but I don't know. After that, we kind of said, screw it. We found the Sonoran hot dog truck and ate a couple of $3 bacon-wrapped hot dogs that were topped with chopped tomatoes and onions and pinto beans and mayo and mustard and salsa verde. We ended up eating them off the hood of our rental car. And then we drove over to a restaurant that's website actually made it look pretty foodie, kind of scrolling photos of nicely plated dishes. But honestly, I almost passed that building by. It looked like a repurposed Arby's or Hardee's with kind of a vinyl sign pulled down over the original one. But the food there, especially the cabrito, the goat tacos, were just phenomenal. Now, not all those dives were great. I mean, some were disappointing, some were kind of meh. But the ones that were great made it worth working through the ones that weren't. But the absolute highlight of the trip, I was standing out on the back patio of our timeshare watching the sun set over the Tucson Mountains. It really was beautiful. But then I heard some rustling kind of off to my right. I looked over and saw what looked like a good-sized wild pig walk out from between two bushes and just like walk right in front of me across the backyard. He kept his eyes on me the whole time. And then another one comes out. And he stops to look at me, and then he keeps walking, and then more kept coming. 5, 6, 7, kind of walking the same path across the backyard. They were javelinas, and Wikipedia told me that their groups are called squadrons. There you go. Well, our squadron looked pretty comfortable here, like they were taking their usual end-of-the-day stroll back to wherever they bed down to stay safe from mountain lions. And the next morning, a couple of javelinas came back. They were kind of sniffing around the patio door. I don't know. Maybe they smelled the egg and toast that I'd made for breakfast. It was kind of fun, but it reminded us to keep the patio door closed. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 172. I hope you all enjoyed the show. I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Nothing new on the tech front this month, but I should have the website freshened up by the next episode. I've had the current website look since the beginning of 2006, courtesy of Travel Commons listener Hillary Bauman and her Fascination Design firm. Now, the change I'm making is absolutely not a knock against Hillary's work. It's just that after, I don't know, what, 15 years, I kind of wanted to freshen things up a bit. So look for that change by the end of this month, by the end of February, beginning of March. And as always, you can find the Travel Commons podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, TuneIn, Amazon Music. You can ask Alexa, Siri, or Google to play Travel Commons on your smart speakers. The links, along with the RSS feeds, are on the right-hand side of the Travel Commons website under the heading Subscribe. Right below that in the social media section are the links to the Travel Commons Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram feeds. If you've already subscribed, how about leaving us a review on one of those sites? It helps people find this podcast and kind of join the gang. As always, if you've got a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send it along. Text or audio file, comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. You can send a note to M. Peacock on Twitter, write them on the Travel Commons page on Facebook, the Instagram site for Travel Commons, or post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, and post comments on the website. I really do appreciate it. And until we talk again next month, take care, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.